Blog Hello? Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. It is Friday night, and welcome to the political consciousness of Slick Pavlovic. Once again, we have been provided with a lot of material from our current administration, but before we get into that, let's introduce at least the first member of our panel that's coming in, Ms. Janet Rennell. Janet, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing as well as I can be in the present atmosphere. Glad to be on the show tonight. Lots to talk about.
Since this is your first appearance on the show, why don't you give us a little bit about your background?
Okay. Well, I was originally from New York, New Jersey. I moved down to Florida in the mid-70s. I have a lot of legal experience. I've been a civil rights activist for a very long time. And then it kind of morphed into other areas, including sports and working with kids that have terminal illnesses and getting Hall of Fame sports figures to spend a day. And it ranges from everybody from football, basketball, racing, horse racing, everything. So I've got a pretty varied background. And a lot of politics, too.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm a Jersey boy myself, having graduated high school in Newark. That was quite some time ago. I imagine most of those buildings have been grounded to dust by now.
I know Newark. I was in Morristown. So it wasn't that far away from Morristown.
Ran track against them. I played little football against them also, so yeah, I'm very familiar with those kinds of
Morristown Colonials.
Yes, ma'am. This goes to show how small the world is, huh?
Sure is. Yeah.
While we're waiting for some of our other panelists to come on, let's kind of get off into some of the things that have happened. Even though I didn't include this because it wasn't a part of the agenda today, but now that we have seen a replacement for Mr. Sean Spicer, what did you think about the replacing of Sean Spicer, the way he handled it, and Mr. Scaramucci?
Well, I didn't really care for Sean Spicer. I do happen to know and I'm actually friends with a former press secretary who was the press secretary for Gerald Ford. And he also had worked for, not as press secretary, but did some things for Ronald Reagan. He's a Republican all the way, and I'm a Democrat all the way, but we always agree to disagree. So we never have problems that way, which is unfortunate that can happen today. I think that Spicer was put into not a very admirable position. I think his hands were tied. He did the best he could. I don't think he really had the temperament, but then again, his background wasn't too bad. As far as, I hate to say it, it sounds terrible, but I'm familiar with Trump properties. I used to go to Atlantic City quite often. I met Mr. Trump a couple of times, and it was very strange. I'll leave it at that. But this Scaramucci, who I don't really know, kind of reminds me of a casino host, to be honest with you. Very slick, you know, the whole kind of, you know, just his whole his mannerisms. And I honestly, I don't really trust the guy. I mean, I don't really know much about him. I was reading up about him tonight, and he looks, you know, his resume looks good. But there's something that I find strange. And he was a Democrat for a really long time. He donated a lot of money to the Hillary Clinton campaign. And he seems to have suddenly fallen in love. I think we heard him say he loved the president about 20 times today in a 30-minute period of time. So I'm not really sure. I wonder, you know, I really wonder why Bannon is so upset about it. I don't know. There's something going on in there that I can't quite figure out. I know that Ivanka wanted him, and so I'm not, I guess that's the final word, because she seems to be the sort of first lady as I see it. And what Ivanka wants, she gets. So I don't know. I'm not too sure how, you know, what's going on, but I'm not real comfortable with it. I think even though, and I don't care for Sarah Huckabee Sanders at all. I just don't, you know, the press secretaries for President Obama, I like them. I like their approach. I like the way they answered questions. You know, I like the way their mannerisms and their respect of the press. And I never felt like they were hiding anything, or they weren't supposed to say something, or if they really couldn't comment on something, they would just say so. So this is not my cup of tea. And then the man that I do know that happens to live in California now, ironically, we're still very, very good friends. And, you know, what I liked even about him is that he even worked for Nixon, and we had discussions about that as well. And at one time, I really thought Nixon was, wow, you know, this is the end. And then Trump came along. So at this point, Nixon doesn't look so bad to me as he did back in the day.
Most definitely. The guy kind of reminds me of a snake oil salesman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you say, you know, all he needs is, you know, just the circus tent and the cane and you know, the little straw hat. But I think, as you said, you know, after renouncing, after showing all the love that he had for the Trump, and being, as you said, a former Democrat, you have to really wonder what are his motivations.
Exactly. 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 You know, I want to just say one thing. When I say a casino host, I have nothing against casino hosts. I have friends that are casino hosts, and I like them a lot. But one I know in particular, I always said to him, in fact, I once gave him a little plaque, and it said, you could tell someone to go to hell and make them look forward to the trip. And that's the feeling I get from this Anthony Scaramucci, or maybe better known as Little Tony, who knows. I just get that feeling from him. There's something, ooh. You know, and I've met a number of men like him in my life. I'm married to a criminal defense attorney. He's actually pretty retired right now, but I think I've seen just about everything, from, you know, everything. I mean, it's been quite a wild ride, and I've been involved myself in a lot of legal and political issues. And it's I just feel like there is an ulterior motive there someplace. I'm not sure what it is. And I'm going to have to do a little more research on this guy. But I just was, I started feeling a little bit like, ooh, I don't know. I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. So
I
think you feel the same way.
Yeah, most definitely. But, you know, speaking of, there were some other things that happened within this past week or two that have also made headlines. And with your legal background, I'm sure you can even give us more insight into what I'm about to ask. And I'm talking about the Australian lady that got shot, of course, in Minneapolis. She was shot by a Somali Muslim. And there's been maybe three trends of thought here. Going back, you know, to Black Lives Matter. And a lot of us, I mean, you know, some of us agree with their agenda. Some of us don't. We all do admit that there's a problem here. Does it seem to you that the police have become more of an arm of law enforcement rather than community protection? Do you think that the police either have kind of inadvertently changed the way they deal with the public, or can we just keep calling all these different things aberrations?
No, I think that the police, you know, not me personally, but I think the police have actually, especially now with social media and cable television and everything else, I think they've been doing this for decades. I don't think it's been getting the publicity that it should have. And I think they feel a little more empowered, emboldened even, because none of them ever seem to have to pay a price. And I can tell you, especially living in South Florida, I started getting involved myself in being an activist because I saw something happen in Miami, which went back to, I'm trying to think exactly when, but a policeman in Miami, and this was before the Miami River cops, I don't know if you remember that, but this policeman was in an area called Overtown.
You're dating us, Janet. You know that, right? You're dating us.
Oh, yeah, I know. I know. But I've got to tell you, and I saw, you know, a policeman who just, I mean, I didn't witness it, but there were many, many witnesses, who just shot a man in cold blood. And he happened to have been an insurance salesman. He was very much loved by the community, and somehow he still wrangled out of it, you know, and that's a thing that I'm seeing more and more. But I think what's happening is it's actually being publicized more. It's getting out there and people are seeing it. So I have my feelings about the police on so many different levels, that I actually did and because my husband's a criminal defense attorney, and he's seen so much, I've got to tell you, he's sued more police departments than probably anybody in the country because of police brutality, you know, not giving people their Miranda rights. I mean, everything under the sun, to a point they started going after him. That was really interesting. But I saw, to tell you the truth, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, you know, I watched, you know, remember, we're dating ourselves again, but remember Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. on the FBI, and, you know, and Perry Mason and all that kind of. And, you know, when I first thought that or heard all these different stories, and I say they're stories because I found them somewhat unbelievable, I just thought, oh, this can't be. This is not the America I know. And then I witnessed it actually to me. It actually happened to me where at work I actually had two men from the Organized Crime Task Force come up to my office with their guns. You could see the guns in their waistband, and you had all the women chattering away and like, what's going on? And they came in to ask me questions about my husband. And did I know what he was doing and the people he represented, which was everybody, you know. And I said, yeah, I mean, is that what you're doing here? Because if that's what you're doing here, you can leave. And they left. And I called him and I said, what was that? And he said, that's called harassment. Get used to it. Because that's what I do. He said, I defend people. Everyone's entitled to a defense. And I'll tell you, he defended a lot of people, especially young black men, pro bono, because he couldn't stand to see the public defenders with the deals, making deals on kids that were terrified. Because in the public defender's office, they'll take a kid, and I'm sure you're aware of this, they'll take a young black man in particular, and they'll say to him, I'll tell you what we're going to do. You can plead guilty, and you'll get 3 years, and if you don't, you're going to get 10. And these kids are scared, and they have no money, and they have the public defender. They don't know what to do, and they wind up pleading. They plead guilty to something they didn't do. And what will happen if he happens to see that, he'll step in and say, I'll be substitute counsel for this young man, and I'd like a continuance. And I'm going to tell you, 9 out of 10 times the case is dismissed because they don't want to go up against him because they know the people that he's had been acquitted, so they don't want to go through it and insist on a jury trial and go through the whole thing. And it's really a scary situation. So I really do identify, and more recently, if you want to go like to the Trayvon Martin thing, that situation, or Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, all that, it's insane. It's insane. When I watched both my husband and I watched Trayvon Martin. It really wasn't supposed to be the Trayvon Martin trial. It was really the George Zimmerman trial, but it became the Trayvon Martin trial. And that was the worst. They didn't even need a defense because the prosecutors just threw the case. They threw it. I mean, they gave them everything. So it's really awful. And these are things that I've witnessed. I can't even begin to ever get my husband on here. He would take up 3 hours of your show. Just telling you, in fact, he's writing a book about it now, the things that he's seen and gone through, and he's made a lot of enemies because of it, and he never cared. He never cared. You know, he wasn't going to be one of the boys. He wasn't going to join the boys' club, and he didn't have time for it, and he felt his feeling is everyone's entitled to a defense, and a good one. So, you know, that's my feelings as far as this situation in Minnesota, to me, is insane. First it was the fellow, I think it was Castile, was that his last name? I'm not sure if I have the last name right. Castile, wasn't that in Minnesota as well?
Yes.
And then that was crazy. That was crazy. I mean, to me, how can that be possible? It's just insane. The Freddie Gray situation, as soon as those first two policemen were acquitted. Let me say, I don't want to say got off. Say they were found not guilty, but on a bench trial. I don't know a good defense attorney that would ever choose a bench trial unless they knew that their man's going to walk. It's as plain as that. And I can tell you that my husband's been practicing over 50 years. He's 20 years older than me. He's been practicing over 50 years. And he said, I would never have a bench trial if I was friends with the judge, which he's never made friends with judges or socialized with judges. but he would never opt for a bench trial in a thousand years. It just would never happen. And as soon as the first two were found not guilty, they all went for a bench trial. And I think they even dropped the charges on the rest of them. And that was just that was horrendous. That was just horrendous. So I think the thing is this has been going on for decades and decades and decades, and it's first coming to light with social media, with the television coverage, with the demonstrations. And the only thing I do fear, I don't think that we're gonna go forward with Donald Trump as president. I really don't, because I feel that he's pretty much against everybody. I mean, unless you voted for him, you know. And that Australian lady, wasn't that a policeman that shot her?
Yes, it was. He was actually a member of the Minneapolis Police Department. He was a Somali Muslim, and that was one of the criticisms. Is you know, since this was a Muslim as well as being a refugee. That shot this tourist. Well, actually, she was becoming a citizen because she was a bride to be.
Right.
That this is treated differently because this is basically what some people consider a black on white crime. Whereas as long as it was white on black or a minority, it wasn't treated with such disgust, I guess, is the word. Now everyone seems to be in a state of outrage, but as you admit, I mean, as you so freely have said before, when you were talking about, you know, this is something that has been going on for decades. As a young man in New Jersey and having a lot of my work being over in New York, I know what it's like to be sort of Gestapo at frisk under Giuliani. I mean, there are so many examples, like you said, in the last 50 years, you know, and I've also been doing a lot of work with incarcerated veterans, especially Vietnam and combat veterans,
mm-hmm.
Behind the fact that, you know, there are a lot of instances where law enforcement might not be aware of exactly, you know, what's going on mentally. We sent a lot of our mental patients out in the street, no longer caring for them in state or sponsored institutions. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with the way things are handled. As well as social media. Social media, probably more than anything else, has been instrumental in pointing some of these discrepancies out. And you just have to wonder, like you said, especially under this administration, what the hell is going on?
I have no idea.
You know, it also showed during this same week that this lady gets killed. It shows the Baltimore police, and these guys do have their body cams on. It seems funny how the police would have their body cams on while they're planning evidence. But they don't have a body cam showing this gentleman shooting from the passenger side through the driver's window
right,
to kill
right.
this man. You know, so,
yeah.
You know,
I thought that was pretty crazy.
You have to wonder where the priorities are here. Let's talk a little bit about.
I was just going to say. I watched Steve Harvey one day talk about how he has to speak to his son or sons and how they have to act, how they have to drive, how they have to conduct themselves if they're stopped. And I found that to be really, really frightening. I've never actually been afraid of the police, and I've actually mouthed off to them pretty much. Only because I'm not afraid of them, you know, grabbing me and throwing me into a cell like they did with that Sandra Bland in Texas. I'm not afraid of that happening. And when I listened to him, and I thought, what a horror. Well, I listened to Sonny Hostin, and like Sonny will say how she thinks about how she'll have to speak to her son, what he can do, what he can't do. And I find that almost incredulous that somebody, and then this country that's supposed to be a free country and supposed to be an example for the world, that anybody has to be afraid to do nothing, you know, to just get in their car and drive to the grocery store and have to worry if they get stopped, they could wind up dead. I mean, that's insanity to me. And I don't know what's happened, if it's really just being brought out now, it's always been that way, or, you know, when I wasn't aware when I was very young, or it does seem like they've been emboldened, though, especially, I would say, even more so since the Mike Brown situation, because I thought that was absolutely crazy, because people kept saying, well, you know, Mike Brown was 6'4" and he was a big kid and blah, blah, blah. Well, that cop was 6'5". And I just can't imagine Mike Brown reaching into a police car to try to get a gun away from a policeman. I just don't think of anybody in their right mind doing that. I mean, to me, that was just like bull, you know. I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. And I think the more that they kind of get away with it, the easier they feel it is, and the less it's going to happen. And there's so many areas of the country that this is happening. I mean, Cleveland with that Tamara Rice. I mean, it's just like insane. Like, what's going on? You know, and I don't see that the Trump administration is going to look to make it any better. And with the privatization of prisons now, it's like, well, we got to keep those filled up. You know, because that's where the money is. I mean, it's just pretty scary all the way around. You know, unless we do something, band together some way. I definitely understand the Black Lives Matter movement. I'm actually very much for it. And I was, you know, I hope I'm not taking up all your time. I did sit by invitation. I was invited to sit on the Martin Luther King Jr. Foundation in Miami. I was the only white person invited. And I did so. I was very honored to do so. And I tried to do as much as I could in the community with homeless people. And I went up to some police. So I say, I don't know, one of these days what's going to happen to me. Because I walked up to the police one time when they were harassing some guys that were homeless. And I said, they're not bothering me. It happened to be outside where I was working. And I said, you know, you're bothering these guys for no reason. You know, you guys got to knock it off. And they looked at me like I was crazy, you know. And actually, I became very friendly with them. And they used to, like, I'd be inside and they'd knock on the door sometimes and they'd say, hey, Jim, we're out here. We just want you to know we're watching out and, you know, watching your car and everything's cool and you stay in there as long as you want. Everything's good. And I got to know them. And I've got to tell you something. My husband would come by sometimes and he'd say, hey, you guys want to do something? Help me move some stuff and this and that. And he'd pay them. And they liked him. They all called him Lou. You know, and they all liked him, and we got along great. And I never felt threatened for a second. not for a second. So it's all about people are people. Everybody is a person. And that's the thing that I think has to be, you know, there are people that I get so upset with because they're so, either they're colorblind, absolute colorblind. People I never dreamed until I would start to say something and they'd be like, wow, really? And I'd be like, yeah, hello, yeah, what's your problem? And it's strange. It's just strange. And especially in Florida, you know, in the South.
Yeah, when you speak of certain sections of the country, you know, you have to kind of revert back and look and you know that there are still some Jim Crow laws and whatnot on the books but it's just amazing to me that I sometimes. As an older black man, especially, find myself being a little discouraged because it actually seems like I'm refighting some of the battles that I fought back in the 70s and
right.
early 80s, you know, and
yeah.
And you would think that with the social media and all the consciousness that a lot of this would no longer be as prevalent as it is. But I want to speak a little bit about, of course, Trump care, Obamacare, however you want to call it. But Mitch McConnell, good old Mitch, says that the GOP doesn't have 50 votes to pass Trump care. But he's seeking to muster enough votes to repeal Obamacare. Now, West Virginia Democrat Joe McManchin says that repealing Obamacare would be inhumane, considering I believe it was the congressional report came out saying that there would be approximately 33 million uninsured if.
Right.
We just repealed it without replacing. Your thoughts on this whole Trump thing?
That to me would be the travesty to end travesties. You know, it took so long. So many people tried to bring a form of health care, you know, to the masses for decades. I mean, literally decades. And we're knocked down every time. And, you know, it took 17 months to pass the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, which, incidentally, you know, you probably know this, but if you go into an area like Kentucky and West Virginia and areas like that, the people there think that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are two different things. So you kind of know where they're coming from. But at the same time, they don't want it taken away. And I can't remember exactly who it was, but it was one of the congressmen said that when somebody doesn't have something, you can't take away something they don't have. But once people have something, to try to take it away, it's pretty darn impossible. I think you're going to survive through it. But it would be incredibly inhumane. Because, first of all, a lot of people are paying into this thing, too. So all the people that are paying in, what happens to them? And what do they do? And I mean, is it going to go back to just going to the emergency room and, you know, that type of thing? You know, I think I have to applaud President Obama. I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. I wish he was still president. Because he worked with them as much as he could, you know. I mean, the Republicans wouldn't give him the time of day, but he worked and worked and worked and did so much compromising and whatever he had to do to get it done, and he got it done. And as Hillary had said, you know, maybe it's not 100% perfect, but you can always improve. But to take it away would just be, you know, I can't even imagine. And I don't think it's going to happen. And the reason I don't think it's going to happen is not because the Republicans care. They don't care. it's because they care about their job. They care about being reelected. They know in 2018 there's an election. If they repeal Obamacare and they don't replace it with something good, which both of their plans were horrible. One was worse and whatever is worse and worse, despicable, I guess. They're not going to be reelected. Because you can see the people, and white people, black people, all people, Hispanics, everyone at these town halls, you know, they're just, you know, really ripping up some of these guys that have been in there forever, saying, you know, you do this, you're done. And so I don't think it's really going to happen. And there are a couple, like, you know, Susan Collins and a few of them that pretty much will not go along, would absolutely not go along. Because if they ever repealed, repealed Obamacare, it would never come back. It took decades to get it. It would never come back. I don't really think he's going to be able to do that. But I just don't think he's going to get to have the votes, because these people are worried about their jobs, and that's why they want to be reelected. It would be inhumane. It would be absolutely, you know, absolutely crazy. And as far as the Obamacare goes, I have a daughter that she was only out of work for about 3 months, but she wanted to have some sort of health care, and she signed up and got Obamacare and used it. And then before she got another job, and just so happened during that time, she had to see a couple of different doctors, and she was like, wow, boy, I'm sure glad that I had that. So it was, you know, it's not just, you know, like the people that have that visualize it, oh, it's the very poor and all this. It's there's a lot of people from all walks of life and all races and religions and everything. I mean, everything that are benefiting. And even if they say, well, the premiums are going up and all this kind of thing, even if they do, you know, and that's not good, but even if they do, you can have it. That's the thing. You have it. And that does give you peace of mind. You know, if something happens, you do have health care, and that's a huge thing not to have. You know, and, you know, most people can't really afford. I mean, health care is crazy. So that's kind of how I feel. So as far as being inhumane, I think we'd be the only country in the world, you know, civilized as we are, a civilized country that doesn't have, in fact, other countries have much better health care, but still what we have now at least is good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when Obama presented it, you know, he knew it was flawed, and you know, they let everyone know it was flawed and that it had to be fixed, but it was something that had to be done. And I have people that are close to me that, were not for Obamacare. They, you know, some of their cancer medications, paying, $3,000 and $4,000 a month for chemo. I mean, you know, this is a big part of anyone's budget that certainly not usually planned for. So, they're kind of caught between I guess you want to call it a rock and a hard place. One way they leave 24 million uninsured. The other way they leave 33 million uninsured. Neither one of these are acceptable numbers in today's age. When you, like you said, considering all the civilized nations generally have better health care than we do.
I just can't imagine going backwards like that.
I know.
Obama killed himself getting this thing done, and he did it because he wanted to help people, and that's the big difference. That I honestly don't understand how people can't see the difference. about having a president that wants to help people, that really, really cares about everybody, versus someone that doesn't care about anybody. I mean, seriously, nobody. It's really ridiculous. And I just don't get it. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that, you know, my feeling about the whole election was, you know, people faulted Hillary for not going to Ohio, not going to West Virginia and whatever, Pennsylvania, whatever. But the thing is that I think she really didn't want to lie to them. You know, as much as it said about the Clintons, I don't think she wanted to go and lie to them and say, I'm going to do this for you, and I'm going to do that for you, and I'm going to do that for you. You know, she did say, you know, tell the coal miners that, you know, it's unfortunate about it, but the coal is not the way to go anymore. We're going to retrain, or we'll do something to get you going. In the meantime, they're sitting there just waiting on coal mines to be reopened, which is really crazy. And eventually they will wake up when time goes by and they realize that what happened? You know, what happened to all those, I can do it, I'll do it on day one, I can do it alone, I don't need help. You know, all that. I can run businesses and be the president, you know, which is ridiculous. But it's just a situation that I recently spoke to my own doctor. He happens to be moving, so I became a new doctor. But I asked him his opinion. And he said, you know, as a young doctor, and he said, there can be improvements. He said, we all know that. He said, but it makes me feel good as a doctor that people are getting health care. He said, that's something I really do. He said, it would be horrible, horrible, horrible if they change it to be practically inaccessible or make it an a la carte menu type thing. Or if they did away with it completely, that would be a horrible thing for people. Because he's still young and he still is not really so much a doctor for the money. He really wants to help people. He really wants to, you know, keep them healthy instead of having to fix something that they never went to take care of because they didn't have the money to do it.
Yeah, and that's not even counting. Know the way that we find things at a lot of the VA hospitals and the VA programs, we'll get into that a whole other program. I've been dealing with them since the 1970s, late 70s, early 80s, and that's one of the reflection of me moving out west to a military town was just because of the lack of care back east. And I'm talking about in some of our major hubs, including Washington, D.C., Walter Reed Hospital, some very famous things that would be included in there. I want to touch a little bit about Mr. Sessions. Trump says he would not have picked Sessions if he had known that he'd recused himself. Now, I will admit, based on his previous record on civil rights and, his record toward black men, civil rights, the whole nine yards, just because of his past, I was very, very skeptical. Not saying that I'm not skeptical now, but it does seem that he has found something that I thought he lacked. Have we underestimated the integrity of Mr. Sessions and his allegiance to Trump? And has he become a liability for Trump?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that Trump felt that, like he expected Comey to do, just back away from the whole investigation, and he didn't, and then there went Comey. But when Sessions recused himself, I think he had to recuse himself because he had he didn't admit it the first time around about his contact with Russians and what have you. And then when that was all brought up and all that, he really backed himself into a corner with that. But I don't think it was because he didn't want to do Trump's bidding, but I think he was just caught and he had to. And ironically, I think it was Al Franken that actually was the one that really held his feet to the fire. But today they came out with something which was, I thought was pretty kind of scary in a way, that apparently there were a couple more discussions that Sessions had with Russians that were not out there. And they say that might give Trump the ability to fire him. Because he's really looking for somebody to come in and fire Mueller, even though Mueller, I think he pronounces it. And if they do that, I heard Adam Schiff, I think, say that Congress will actually appoint him as special prosecutor like they did with Ken Starr, where he could just do what he wants and you can't fire him. But with Sessions, I was not happy with his choice to begin with because I know Sessions' record myself. And I thought, oh, my God, this is a nightmare. And, I mean, where will the whole Department of Justice be with civil rights? It will be gone. It will just disappear. But I think he was actually forced into that recusal. I think he did that somewhat reluctantly, but he had to do it. He had to do it, and once he did it, that was it. And I think that's what, and I think would disappoint Trump, because Trump thought he had him in his pocket and he would stop anything from happening. And so I think Sessions himself is probably thinking, what did I get myself into right now? You know, I had a real cushy job for decades as a senator, and I gave it up for this, and, you know, I may be out myself now. But I don't have a lot of respect for Sessions in any event, you know, because I listened to his testimony, and, you know, he's pretty cute the way he crafts his answers, but nevertheless, it still is what it is, no matter how you cut the tape. So I don't know, but I think he's now looking for a reason, and he may have found one, to get rid of Sessions. Because, you know, as you could tell from Comey, Trump wants you to pledge your allegiance to him, not to the Constitution. So it's, in fact, I'm trying to remember the other fellow's name. He may be having to get rid of a few people before he can get somebody. Rothstein or something?
Something like that.
And I'm not too sure that he would fire him either. So then he'll probably wind up having to resign, you know. And it's kind of Nixon-esque, but, you know, by comparison, you know, they were comparing Nixon to Trump, and my God, Nixon was like a Boy Scout by comparison, because of things. I heard someone talking about Bill Clinton when they went through that, and it started with Whitewater. You know, they started with the big stuff, Whitewater and nothing, FBI gave nothing, travel gave nothing, all these things, nothing, 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 and wound up with, you know, Monica Lewinsky, which really a little bit crazy. But, you know, everything kept getting done, and he kept moving the country forward at least at the same time. Because it was something on a personal level than something where our national security could be really at risk, and who knows what's going on with them. And it's actually pretty scary at this point. So if he does get rid of him in an effort to get rid of Mueller, then I hope that Adam Schiff is right that Congress can, which they did do, you know, with Ken Starr, and appoint him as special prosecutor instead of special counsel. But I'm not a fan of Sessions anyway, you know, in any event, because I don't think he would, if anything, he'd make things worse instead of better as far as the actual country, the actual population, particularly the black population. Because, I mean, he never left Alabama. You know, he's still there in his head, in his heart. So that's kind of how I feel about it.
He never left the 60s Alabama. Not just Alabama.
Exactly.
He never left the 60s Alabama.
Right. Yeah. And I'm trying to think the other day who I was, oh, my goodness, no, this is, I was actually surprised. I know it's just mistaking me in the name. Oh my goodness! It's something that was had when JFK was killed. This man broke down, and then when RFK and Robert Kennedy was killed, this man broke down, and when Martin Luther King was killed, he broke down. I'm just trying to think who it was because it was surprising to me. God, I just can't think of his name now, who it was. But I was thinking, wow. Oh, I know who it was. It was Marlon Brando. I saw a documentary on Marlon Brando. And Marlon Brando was really a real civil rights activist, which I didn't really, I heard that. And I knew he was for the Native Americans, but I didn't realize that he was so such a big activist with civil rights. And he had actually given an interview right toward the end of his life. And he was saying that when Jack Kennedy was killed, he actually broke down and cried. And he said when Martin Luther King, who I didn't know he had a relationship with him, but he had a very good relationship with him. And he said when he was killed, he said he broke down and he cried and just thought, like, what? You know, what is going on here? And then he said when they killed Bobby Kennedy, he said that was it. He just broke down and he just couldn't deal with it anymore. And that's when he really started living in wherever, Tahiti or wherever it was, because he just couldn't stand it. And one of the things he actually liked about it was when he went to, I think it was Tahiti, everybody was the same. Everybody was equal. It didn't make a difference if you were a movie star, if you were just a regular person, if you were white, if you were black, if you were a Tahitian, nothing. Everybody was equal. And he loved it. And that's why he loved it as much. So I was actually pretty surprised about that. You know, I had no idea.
Yeah, like you said, you'd be surprised sometimes if you look back in history and find out exactly who's lined up on which sides here. But you spoke of national security, so in the last couple minutes here, let's talk a little bit about these G20 meetings. We've discovered or heard that Trump has had more than one undisclosed meeting with Putin while he was at the G20s. One of the high-ranking Russian officials actually made some jokes about it on Meet the Press, I believe it was. Are we making too much of these meetings? Are we making more of them than we should?
You know, I don't really think so. I really think that, I mean, Putin really runs the show, and anybody that thinks he doesn't is really wrong. He really is trying to turn Russia back into the USSR. And I think that what Trump really was looking at for himself, you know, making tons of money. That's what I really think his motivation was. And Putin, of course, is looking for Trump to lift sanctions and pretty much let him go haywire. And somebody definitely has been talking to Trump, who was a lifelong Democrat, to degrade NATO and all the things that he's doing and act. I mean, frankly, the way he acted at that G20 was embarrassing. So I don't really think so, and I don't know if he even understands to what degree our national security is at risk when he thinks it's funny to tell Russians in the Oval Office just, you know, that was the other thing he did. Russians haven't been invited to the Oval Office, I don't think, ever. And, I mean, they would meet, but not, you know, in Washington, but not in the Oval Office with their own stenographer and their own photographer. Not to mention whatever, devices they may have had with them. And then for him to divulge that there were people that were men that were embedded in ISIS in Syria, and it was Israel. And then for them to say, well, it's not a big deal because he didn't tell them what country it was. And then he went to Israel and actually said, I didn't tell him it was Israel. This was on national television. So I can only imagine that Netanyahu probably wanted to throw him out. But because those Israeli guys are, if they get caught, you know, by ISIS, we all know where they're going to wind up. But I don't think we're really making too much of it, because what's happening is I feel like Trump is looking at our real allies and our real friends as though they're second-class citizens, and that Russia is like, you know, the place to be, the place, you know, the great almighty, because you see how he'll never say a bad word about Putin. For some reason, he just adores him. I honestly think that Trump feels Putin is, he wants to be Putin. He wants to be the dictator, the emperor, the king. No, he doesn't want to have all these rules and regulations and laws and Congress and, you know, what is all this? And you know, appellate courts and, you know, things like that. Like, they're in his way. So I don't think we're overreacting to that at all. And we don't even know what they're saying, which is the bad part. If we knew what they were saying, maybe it would be a different story. We'd feel like, okay, well, he's playing on putting up another hotel or something. But, and the other situation is that one of his sons had said how they were borrowing so much money from Russia, from Russian banks, because American banks won't loan to them anymore. And so he's indebted to them as well. And, you know, we're talking not, I don't know how much we're talking about, but I'm sure it's probably into the billions at this point for all the different places he's building all over the world. So it's I found something interesting. You and I know of Trump because you know him because you're a New Yorker originally, or New Jersey, New York, like me, and you've seen his buildings and you know about the golf courses and all that. But I was actually surprised to hear last week that a lot of Middle America and a lot of areas that aren't as sophisticated, let's say, as maybe the East Coast and the West Coast, only really know Trump from The Apprentice, which is incredible. And The Apprentice was a reality show, and I only found this out last week, because even I thought that The Apprentice, at the end, you know, when he would say you're fired and all that whole spiel that he would go through, there was actually a teleprompter embedded in the desk that he sat at, and he would be off the teleprompter. So the whole thing was scripted, which I really didn't even know that myself. And Clay Aiken, you know, one of the contestants, was the one that came out and said that last week. So up until then, I knew it wasn't his show. He didn't own the show. It wasn't his money. You know, but I didn't realize it was scripted down to the "you're fired" part. But most of the people, like in the areas that are not that sophisticated, are that's the only thing they know about him, which, you know, of course, they played him up to be this phenomenal, you know, tremendous real estate magnate type of thing, which they don't realize and understand the bankruptcies and the casino failures and, you know, all that type of thing. And he was turned, you know, he was turned down 7 times in Nevada for he wanted a gambling license in Nevada, and they went 7 times and they wouldn't give it to him. So when you turn down there, that's it.
And he was also turned down for an NFL team also. Panelists on. Nodge, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. How you guys doing?
We're doing well.
Hi,
man.
Nodge.
I'm glad you were able to catch us right here at the end of the program. We knew you were going to be a little bit late, but we were talking about this whole G20 episode here, how now we have the Russians almost making jokes about it on TV. Maybe they went to the bathroom together,
I saw that.
Me and Janet were talking about, do you think that we're making too much of supposed meetings between Putin and Trump, or is this something that the American public should really be concerned about, considering, as she said, the nuclear codes, some of the things that were leaked in the Oval Office? Your thoughts on that, Nod?
Well, it kind of goes to what you just said. This is a man who couldn't pass the rigors of owning a football team, and he's elected president. So, you know, you're going to have a problem. When it comes to certain matters, he's a bumbling fool. So you're watching a guy be led around the nose by a lot of the old school apparatus, and then these new swamp figures that he's brought into the fray. The old days, you had to have a middleman. You'd have your politician, and they get the money from the billionaire and then act in the billionaire's interest. Well, he directly hires the billionaire, and then they do this open-faced bad policy that we all don't agree with. So, I mean, that's what we're seeing in real time. And as far as Russia goes, because there's so much smoke, anything he does concerning Russia or speaking to Putin, yes, everyone has to pay attention to that. And then you think of the power dynamic of a whole nation being suspicious of him in Russia, then – you know, what really does he have as far as leverage when it comes to talking to Putin? Because Putin's always operating from a position of strength with him. So it sounds like bad outcomes. And then, like you said, the relationship that's going on with him in Europe, you know, good night. Once you set that as the condition, yeah, things are going to look bad for him as far as, you know, them two having any conversation or any policy. But Jelani Cobb, professor at Columbia, he had a lecture recently where he just compared this to McCarthy. This is essentially McCarthy actually getting far enough to win. Like, McCarthyism works from the outside, to where you just always make the accusations, you say the ridiculous things, but then if you're asked to govern, then it all falls apart because you're not fully equipped to do that. The demagoguery doesn't work when you actually have to institute policy. And I think we're seeing that every time he falls on his face when he comes, you know, with these horrible positions that he can't defend, let alone understand. And, you know, we're just watching this, and it's like, okay, the presidency is somewhat diminished just by him sitting in that chair. And just quickly, I want to say, too, the idea of the G20 is horrific and horrible, and we should not have this concept of certain nations deciding how the rest of the world shall live. So I do want to add that, too, about the G20.
I would like to – who would you want to eliminate from the G20?
No, I'm talking about the whole concept. I don't think the so-called first world should be deciding the dietary – ability of the third world or the resource management of the third world let alone the war-making abilities or border disputes and everything else. So I'm against the whole concept of a G20. But to see an American president be ignored at the G20, I think is a damning picture to see.
Well, I think he brought that upon himself because when Obama was president, I mean, he was welcomed there with open arms. They loved him. He sat down. He could speak to anybody, and he was respectful to everyone and listened, which I think that was one of Obama's strengths is he would listen, and he would listen and think, and he always thought before he spoke and didn't just go off half-cocked and say something ridiculous or do something ridiculous. Where with Trump, I really think he's – it's almost as though are you aware? You aware of what the Peter Principle is? I imagine.
Excuse me.
You've heard of the Peter Principle? Have you?
No, you'd have to go into
no?
it.
No. Okay. What it actually is like, let's say you're in a company and you're getting promoted, and you're doing great, and then they finally promote you to something you really can't do, you really don't know, and you find yourself thinking, you know what, like, you know, I don't know what to do about this. And but you don't really want to tell anybody. And Bill Clinton did say something years ago, and he wasn't in the presidency anymore. I think Bush was in. But I remember hearing him say, I don't care if you've been a governor, I don't care if you've been a senator, I don't care if you've been in politics your whole life. The day you sit behind that desk in the Oval Office as president, you realize – like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is way bigger than I ever could have imagined. Now you take a guy who is not really a successful businessman. I mean, he's cash poor, debt high, but he's got all his name all over the place. Now, so did Bin Laden. Bin Laden, his name is all over Saudi Arabia. His father's name, I should say, because he built most of Saudi Arabia. But the thing is that I think that Trump, who didn't believe he was going to win either, once he got in there, he probably thought, oh, my God, like, I'm clueless. I have no idea. And then he hired people that also didn't have any idea. So, I mean, it was like dumb and dumber, you know, when it came to that. But, you know, like I was saying to James, that I think a lot of this this whole Russian thing, I think Trump is looking to enrich himself. You know,
I wouldn't question that at all. The emoluments, accusations that have been brought up, all of them seem valid. Now, the issue with the emoluments, there's no, like, real stiff penalty. It's just you stop doing it. And, you know, the reason it was created was because America was behind the European powers early on, and they had to make sure European influence through money or prestige or gifts didn't determine the route of the country. So you got this, like you said, cash poor guy who couldn't get a loan in America, who's funded by these banks, Deutsche Bank and these other places.
Right.
And it's like, okay, everything stinks to high heaven. You can't tell me there's nothing there. So, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there definitely is a there. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, it's, you know, there's some people that are just diehard Trump supporters and they don't want to hear anything else. And eventually they will, because they'll have to. They'll look out the window and see there are no new steel mills. There are no new factories, there are no new, all these things he's promised that are going to just spring up, it's not going to happen. But it's, with the whole Russian thing, I really think it gets to be a point of national security. He feels like he's making friends with them. And I don't think anybody alive can, I don't think Putin is a friend to anybody. You know, I really don't. I think,
Putin a great pivot. Like, think about this.
Oh.
Russia is really bad off economically right now.
Absolutely.
The inequality there is way worse than here. They have more billionaires per capita than almost any nation on earth. So the economic inequality is ridiculous. They really have nothing except trying to appeal to an old idea of the USSR and the strong Russian bear. So Putin plays that figure. That's what he's trying to do. So you kind of allow them to skate on not fixing the things in their nation and a possibility of them being China's junior partner. You allow him to skate on all of that because of, you know, the situation with Trump. He's projecting himself as a world power that they're not. Their intervention in Syria is pretty much the limit of their power, where they could say, okay, we'll go in, protect an ally, and keep an asset we want in power in power. But at best, that's the most they could do on the global stage. But this Trump figure kind of allows Putin to look like a much more successful and bigger leader, I guess we'll say, than what he is.
Yeah, exactly, which is why and he really wants him to – if he lifted those sanctions – that would be a giant coup for Putin. Putin would look like a hero, and that's something that if the Congress allows him to do, would just be a travesty. It would just be terrible, because it would just embolden Putin even more.
Yeah.
Another thing I kind of like the two of you to comment on, if you don't mind. He made a big deal about, you know, bringing American-made things to the White House. He put on his Stetson hat, you know, showed the Caterpillar brand out front and whatnot. But yet and still, his daughter, as well as some of his son-in-law's businesses, are being trademarked in China. He hasn't talked about moving any of those jobs back to America. What did you think about the hypocrisy of him touting out all of these American products and wearing a suit that says "Made in China"?
I was personally really outraged because not even his daughter, he still has 70 different types of products being manufactured outside the United States, in China, in Bangladesh, in India. I mean, all over, everywhere. He has two things that are made here. One is the crazy red hat, and I forgot what the other thing is, but it was something else that was small. And of course, Ivanka had all her stuff that's made in China, and their businesses all over the world. You know, I mean, it's a horrible situation. And I remember him criticizing, when Obama was president, he was criticizing the fact that he was using, I'm trying to remember the name of it, I think it's Komatsu or something like that. It's a rival, you know, it's a rival to Caterpillar. It's made in Japan. I think it's, you know, it does all what Caterpillar does, you know, I guess the digging and all those yellow machines you see all over the place. I think it's called Komatsu or something like that. And he's using them instead of Caterpillar. So I thought, I can't even believe you're talking about Caterpillar when you personally, for your own projects, are using the Japanese construction materials. Or like when he was saying that pipeline was going to be built with American steel. There isn't any American steel. Yeah, so it was built with Chinese and Russian steel. And then finally, I think the court stopped that. But, which, you know, everybody's terrible on the court, too. But, I think it's just a completely hypocrite. What? Asian. Yeah, Asian. It's not Chinese, now it's Asian. No.
It's Canadian now.
I was Canadian.
Oh, after he threatened him with renegotiating NAFTA, and then when everybody explained to him why that was unworkable, then he just walks away from it. That moment you're talking about, that's one of those moments where we always got to remember there's sometimes where he's not talking to us. He's talking to that base that he is conned into thinking certain things, who have blinders on. And as long as he gives them the flash and the symbol, they can continue to support him. Because when you're dealing with a con man, the last thing you want to admit is that you've been conned. So you continue to buy in because you have to. Otherwise, you have to admit that you were fooled. So that's the dynamic that he's dealing with, and he knows he has to give his base the symbolic stuff, the carrier so-called deal that he promised them,
right,
or told
exactly,
them that he made
exactly.
happen. And then, you know,
yeah.
that falls apart immediately because it was already worked out that they would be leaving, you know, during the Pence administration. So, you know, this is more of the same. We always get the flash. We never get the substance. And we really got to do something about his base. It's a form of radicalization. When you talk
it
about
is,
people watching YouTube videos for hours and, you know, believing certain things that are just not true.
You know, it's interesting because that's what we were talking about, that, you know, say, West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio and all these people that he's promised there's going to be jobs, there's going to be this, there's going to be that and everything else. And then if you combine that with, God forbid, they just repeal Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, now these people can wake up to have no health care, to have no Medicaid, to have no job, to have nothing. And that might be what it's going to take to get them, well, maybe not that far, to get them to realize, how long can you wait when he said on day one, you're going to have, we're going to have steel mills on day one, we're going to have coal mines are going to be active again, and all this type of thing. Well, we're way past day one. And
yeah.
it probably won't come around till about maybe close to Christmas or something, when these people are really hurting and they're going to be thinking, wait a minute, like, how long is this going to take? Nothing's
right.
happened for us. Nothing, no, and really, nothing has happened for them. They don't care what the stock market is because they don't own stock. They don't
right.
care about that. They don't understand it. They don't care about it. And that's why last week I heard somebody saying that when they go home, nobody asks about Russia. They ask about jobs. Well, true, because they don't have one. So,
mm-hmm.
but eventually those people, that base, is going to say, where are the jobs? Where are the jobs?
Yeah, there becomes a point to where making liberals mad online is not enough of a payoff for them. So the enjoyment of tormenting liberals on Facebook and Twitter, that's not going to feed your family. So that's it's going to come to a stop. And one thing we forget about the Obama chess move with Obamacare is people forget that came from the Heritage Foundation, the whole idea of an individual mandate. And it's so far to the right that the right doesn't have an answer besides tax cuts to try to deal with it. So
exactly.
they can't come up with a relevant policy, and they're just spinning their wheels now. And, you know, they ran
exactly.
on repeal and replace, and they don't have a replacement that's viable.
No, it's not. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And so their last thing was, why don't we just repeal it, and over the next 2 years we'll come up with a new one, would be absolutely the death knell, because
yeah.
it would never, ever happen again. It took decades for it to happen. And people, I mean, you always hear them say, you know, or try to spin it and say, oh, it's failing, it's terrible, it's in a, you know, a death spiral and everything else. But people that I know that have it love it. They love it. They're just so happy they have health care. I mean, you know, like my mom passed away, she had bladder cancer, and she had Medicare, and she had a gap policy. And it was a good thing because at the last few months, they were giving her one shot a week. That was a $2,500 shot. And I was like, wow, man, like, that is, like, crazy. So what happens
yeah.
if you don't have insurance? What happens to you then? I mean,
right.
do you not get the $2,500 shot? I mean, they're not just going to just hand it out. So it's something that's horrible.
You get there for $125 then.
Interestingly enough, I had a conversation with a gentleman tonight where he was telling me the free market would fix all this. And I was trying to explain to him, healthcare is not breakfast cereal. Nobody's going to
mm-hmm.
take the store brand version of, like, you can get the store brand version of Fruit Loops, but you're not going to take that with a doctor. Like, nobody's.
Right.
He didn't get it, but
exactly.
you know, he wanted to keep saying free market, free market, free market. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you right. remember when we went to the hospital and we considered the Indian doctor or the Japanese doctor, we considered them inferior. Do you remember? I mean, you might
with all of our American arrogance going in there, like, yeah,
yeah.
Some of the most sophisticated people in the world who've come over here to work, and we're looking at them.
We have run a little bit over because I wanted to make sure that we got Nas in, and I want both of you to think of this question before you give us your final thoughts. We have Manafort and Trump Jr. They're not. They're supposed to testify supposedly in open hearings until we've heard otherwise. I think that's supposed to start Wednesday. Mr. Kushner, he's supposed to testify behind closed doors and closed sessions. Naz, do you think that this will be the first breach of the Trump castle and people are going to start scurrying like rats from a sinking ship?
Yeah, you're going to have some problems with this because the one thing about what I call paper gangsters, the gangsters who do things in political realms and high levels of business realms, they're not used to pain and what the justice system can do to you. So it's not like breaking up the mafia. These aren't guys who are going to say, I'll do 14 years, I'll do 10 years, or, I'm not going to say anything. It becomes immediately save myself to hell with the rest of you. So they know if they apply pressure at the right points, they're going to be able to flip one, that flips another, and that flips another, and so on and so on. So, I mean, Mueller and all these other people, they know who they're dealing with, and they know these people do not want any parts of jail.
Exactly. And I'll tell you something. The one I think that is probably really going to help to, I don't know what, it may blow up the whole White House. I probably shouldn't say that. But is Flynn. And I'm going to tell you, I have a friend that's a brigadier general that was involved in the Iraq War. And when he first started running around with Flynn, I didn't know who Flynn was. And I emailed him and I asked him, I said, you know, who is this General Flynn? I know Obama had fired him at one point for something. And he wrote back and he said, oh, guy, he said, Flynn is as crazy as they call him. He's a loose cannon. He used to sit with Sam McChrystal with these bizarre, just go in and, just bombs away. I mean, for real. He said he's got to be looking for some sort of a spot, but Trump better be careful if he wins. But nobody thought he would. He said, but he's not going to win. And this fellow, this general knows Hillary, and he felt she would win. He couldn't understand how she couldn't win, and he felt that she was definitely the most qualified, probably more qualified than anybody. And Flynn apparently has even more, much more than this breeder general knew. He just knew that he was a little bit like nuts. And Flynn is going to definitely, he probably will get immunity. And when he flips, boy, because he's even said already, I have a story to tell. And when somebody says, I have a story to tell, and he was the one that was running around with the lock her up thing. So I think, and I have a funny feeling, I don't know anything for sure, but I have a funny feeling Flynn's already been talking to Mueller, and I think that Trump is terrified of Flynn because he knows what he knows, because he was talking to the Russians and everything during the whole transition, and I mean it's proven. Plus, he was working for the Turks at the same time. I mean, the whole thing is berserk. I mean, you couldn't make this up. And then Manafort, from my understanding, Manafort was buying, I was telling James about my husband's a criminal attorney, and he's done a lot of, white collar crime, too. But, I mean, defended it. But he's done all kinds of criminal, everything from drug dealers to mob guys to everybody, everything, name it, he's done it, except taxes. He doesn't like to go near taxes. But with Manafort, what he was doing was he was going in and buying, say, an apartment in Trump Tower. Let's just take a number like $15 million, right? And let's say it was worth $10 million. $15 million and under a shell company, turn around and get a mortgage on it, and then walk. And that's how they're laundering the money. And that's serious. It's serious time involved with that. So, you know, as you say, you know, these guys don't want to be in prison. These guys couldn't handle prison. And they're not going to country club prisons. And they're not going to get, you know, 6 months to a year. This is big time. This is like, you know, like mob time. Because it's racketeering. And money laundering, racketeering, you know, whatever. It involves a lot of time. And as you say, I mean, these guys don't want to ever get near a jail or prison. I mean, they'd never survive. No, actually, listening to OJ, I thought it was pretty funny. He said, I'm trying to think, who did he say it wouldn't last a day? He couldn't cut in line in prison, no matter who you are. And I had to laugh about it because it's actually true. I'm trying to think who he was talking about now. It slips my mind. But he was talking about somebody. And, like, if that person went to prison, like, they would get special treatment. He said, nobody cuts in line in prison, no matter who you are. And so it's not always the movies. No, that's the thing. So, yeah. I hope it is the beginning of the end, and I hope the end comes fast. I do think since Mueller's got like 30 of the best working for him, you know, forensic attorneys and, I mean, really heavy-duty attorneys that really get into the thick of it, and he's working 7 days a week, I mean, around the clock practically. And my understanding is he's already got his tax returns, which wouldn't surprise me at all.
Well, they're having trouble with how to discredit a man with a silver star and a purple heart. So they don't know how to attack Mueller. They want to, but they don't know what to do.
And a Republican, too, on top of it.
Yep.
And the man that was the FBI director before and after 9/11. Well, so, you know, it's tough.
Almost two terms, considering his term with Obama. We do have to get off of here next week, maybe, since I know we're all into this, maybe I'll schedule the program for a little bit longer instead of just an hour, because we all seem to have a lot to say and we all enjoy talking about the subject. So maybe we'll extend the program a little bit. Nas, I'd like to thank you for joining us. Janet, this is your first time on the show, so why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on social media and any final words you might have for our audience tonight.
Well, let's see. I'm on Facebook and I'm on LinkedIn, and that's probably the two best places to find me. My final words is that, you know, on another show, I'd like to get back in because we weren't joined by Notch till later, and go back and talk a little bit more about the police and the whole situation with them. And, you know, we didn't get into the planting of evidence, which we were going to, but we just kind of went on. We kind of morphed into different areas. And I've got a lot to say about that too. So, you know, I thought this was a pretty good discussion, and definitely opened up lines of communication. I think that's really important, to open up honest lines of communication and really just put it out there and just say what it is and how we really feel and what we think needs to be done and how to get it done. You know, the right way. And we have to keep pushing, and we can't just let it go, because my biggest fear is I fear for the country at this point on so many different levels. I fear for it, not just on a national security level, but I fear for it on the civil rights level, on this whole immigration thing. I mean, all of this is it's got to be addressed, and it just can't go on. We're going to wind up being Russia, and really.
Well, hopefully, you can make time to come and talk with us again next week, and we'll keep an open dialogue as always. So, thank you for your time.
Now you want
to tell? I know you said you were off social media for a while. You want to give us your final thoughts and any concerns that you might have?
Yes, still taking my social media break. I feel better. It's making me healthy, I think. And and I want to say to all the people who made the calls and put the pressure on to stop both of those healthcare bills, you are what matters, and we have to continue to push. This is not going to be done for us. There's not going to be a magical political maneuver that happens in the middle of the night while we're sleeping. No, it has to be resistance, active participation in our republic, and push the Democrats to the left. I will continue to say that until my dying day. Continue to push the Democrats to the left. That is our job. We need actual Democratic policies, not corporate Democratic policies, working class, regular folk Democratic policies.
Right. Can I ask you one other thing, James? I don't know if we have time. Did you happen to watch the ESPYs? Did you watch the ESPYs?
No, I just saw a little highlight.
The ESPY Awards? Oh, did you not? Did you see the ESPY Awards?
No, I didn't. Just saw a highlight.
Didn't. At the very end of the, they gave the Courage Award this year, not to Caitlyn Jenner, but to they gave it to Eunice Kennedy. No. The Courage Award went to Eunice Kennedy Shriver. And, you know, she's the daughter of Joe Kennedy and the sister to Jack and Bobby and everybody, and started this whole Special Olympics. At the end of it, I wish you could just see the end of it somehow. You might be able to get it from someplace. Just the end of it, like the last 15 minutes.
On YouTube.
Yeah. There's her son accepted the award. His name is Timothy P. Shriver. You know, his uncle was Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. And he spoke for 10 minutes straight, and everybody at the ESPYs, and there had to be thousands there, and black, white, Asian, everything you can imagine. And nobody could take their eyes off this man. He was so classic, say, Bobby Kennedy. He was so good that you've got to see it. I'm begging you to see it. I'm sure it must be on YouTube, because it was. And I said this man should be the president because he's classic Kennedy. It's just amazing. And everybody in the audience, you could hear a pin drop. It was just, they were just stunned. They were stunned. Like, look at this guy. You know, like, where is he? And he's right now, he's the chairman of the Special Olympics, and he's about 55, I think. But I'm telling you, he's something else, and he's really worth watching. So if you have a chance in the next week, take a look at that. Right at the end of the ESPYs, and it was the Courage Award, and it went to Eunice Kennedy Shriver.
Yeah, I do remember that award because it was she was talking about how they used to bring the kids to the house every summer. Her mother used to bring the kids to the house every summer.
What she did was amazing. Yeah. I mean, absolutely amazing. But his acceptance speech for her award was mind-blowing. I mean, so you have to see that, because this is the man that should be sitting in the Oval Office right now. And you'll know when you really listen to him. And nobody said a word. I mean, for 10 minutes. Can you imagine that many people in at the a sporting award ceremony that you don't hear a word? And everybody's glued to this guy. Everybody. It was amazing.
Yeah, maybe we'll download it and put it up on the site along with the podcast. I hope everyone has the length of the podcast. But if you don't, just go to the Political Consciousness of Slick Pavlovic, and you can see most of us that are involved. Naj is the mystery man there with the tuxedo. Janet, as I said, we hope to have you back next week, and we thank both of you for your participation, and I look forward to talking to you both again next week. Have a great night.
Okay,
everyone.
Great. Okay,
same
great.
To you. Good night to both of you.
Okay, you too. Good night to both of you. Bye-bye.